Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Vav Amud Bet, about six lines up. Amar Rav Chista, the olam al yatil adam ema yitera b'toch beito, that a person should not rule with an iron fist within his house or impose a certain amount of fear within his house. Sherei Pelegesh b'giva, in the story of Pelegesh b'giva, yitil alea bala ema yitera, because that was the precipitating event for Pelegesh b'giva, that her husband was very makpid and got extremely angry when things didn't go right. And from that, v'ipila kami revavot mi'Yisrael. And that ended up killing out tens of thousands mi'Yisrael with the whole incident between Binyamin and the other Shvatim, all as a result of the incident at Pelegesh b'giva. So obviously referencing back to the Gemara right beforehand as to what the explanation of Tizne alav pilaksho was. Gemara assumes that the problem was that because he was so makpid and was ruled over his house with an iron fist, that the woman was so afraid to tell him the truth or to take care of the issue, that that's what led to this problem. So I'm Rabbi Yehuda Marav, Kolomatil Emayute Rab Toch Beito, anybody who instills this relentless fear within his house, Sofu Bali De Shlosha Veirot, he ends up violating these three sins, Gilui Arayot, Shvichut Damim, V'chilul Shabbat, that's one girsa that they have, based on the fact that by Pelegesh b'giva, you have all of these problems, you have Gilui Arayot, you have Shvichut Damim. Chilul Shabbat is based on the Midrash that the incident of Pelegesh b'giva took place on Shabbat. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Chananel had an alternate girsa, which was Gilui Arayot, Shvichut Damim, and Chilul Hashem, which would make some sense also, probably something along those lines of cardinal sins, or sins that are of very, very severe nature. And so therefore, Gilui Arayot, Shvichut Damim, Chilul Hashem would make sense in that context. Amar Rabba Bar Chana, Handa Amrei Rabbanon, that which the Rabbanon say in the Mishnah and Bamei Medikim that we say every Friday night, the second parak in the Gemara and Shabbat, Shlosha Dvarim Tzrich Adam Lomar B'teich Beito Erev Shabbat Im Chashecha. There are three things that an individual should say in his house on Erev Shabbat before it falls dark. Isartem, Iravtem, Hidliku Et Aner. Those are the three questions that he should pose to his house. Tzarich the merminhu benichuta. You have to say them in a gentle manner. He probably learns it out from the fact that the Mishnah itself says tzarich shadvarim tzarich adam lomar. They have to say them. Say them indicates a certain amount of gentleness or ease in which he says them because of the same reason as before. Kehechi delekavlu mine, so that they will listen to him and they will take care of them and they will tell him the truth. Because if he does it again, with instilling fear and screaming, he says these things, they're going to be so afraid to tell him the truth that they won't do it, or if they haven't done it, they'll end up lying to him about these issues. So as far as the issues, Isartem is taking off Trumot Masrot. That is because one cannot remove Trumot Masrot on Shabbat. One can also not remove them Ben Hashmashot unless it is Demai. Otherwise, you can't remove them Benesh Mashot. So one of the things that you're checking is Isartem. Did you take off all the Trumot Masrot from the produce that we're going to eat on Shabbat? Iravtem, Rashi claims, is Eruvei Chatzerot, is an Eruv that allows one to carry in areas that otherwise would be prohibited Midrabanan in the Chatzer. Tosafot disagrees and says that can't be referencing Eruvei Chatzerot, but rather it's referencing Eruvei Tchumin. For Eruv Tchumin, the ability to walk certain distance on Shabbat in a direction, you're only allowed to go 2,000 amot. If you put on an Erev, it extends your ability to walk in that direction. And the last is Hidliku Et Aner. Did you light the candles for Shabbat? Which seemingly is the last thing that you're going to do prior to the Shabbat. This also plays into the issue of whether there was actually a bracha on Nerot Shabbat. Again, we've discussed this in Bei Medikim. It's a topic for there. But it was a very large machloket in the Geonim as to whether you make a bracha on Hadlakat Nerot Shabbat. And some of the Geonim Rishonim see this Hidliku Et Aner actually as Kabbalat Shabbat. That the last thing you do is a pi'ula, an action that is a malacha that you need for Shabbat that specifically surrounds Shabbat. And Hidliku Et Aner is you lit the candles, and that signifies the last malacha that you do going into the Shabbat and is in essence a Kabbalat Shabbat. And the question of whether you make a bracha or not has to do with whether you're really doing any necessarily religious act, or are you simply lighting candles that you need for the Shabbat? So that is a discussion in the Gemara in Shabbat in Bamei Madlikin, a machloket in the Gonim and the Rishonim. So now, Amar Rav Ashi, Ana lo shmi ali had Rabba Bar Chana. I didn't hear this memra of Rabba Bar Chana, v'kiyamtia misvara. But I was able to come about it logically. It's a understandable principle that one should speak gently within his house, convey information gently, ask questions gently. Therefore, they get the true answer instead of people lying to them because they're too scared to tell them the truth because of the repercussions of telling the truth. Rabbi says one should not instill this type of extreme fear within his house. Great person did this within his household. And then they ended up feeding him something big. Obviously, the something big here is negative and sort. Oh, Manu. Who is this individual? He's speaking in a veiled terms about big guy and big Avera. Who are these individuals and what was the Avera? Manu, Rabbi Chanina ben Gamliel. Rabbi Chanina ben Gamliel, seemingly part of the Shoshelet HaNisi'im, the son of Rabbi Gamliel of Yavne. So he is part of the Nisi'im and probably ran a large household and probably dealt in a very firm manner with the household. You think they fed him? He ate something that was asur. When it comes to the animals of tzaddikim, Hashem doesn't allow anything bad to happen to them. How could it be that tzaddikim themselves would trip up over this thing? The reference is, again, to a Gemara that deals with the chamor of Rav Pinchas ben Yair, who he rented out. And when he rented out to this individuals, they were feeding him in the chamor, the donkey refused to eat. And they figured out the reason that the donkey refused to eat is because they were trying to give him tevel instead of items that were usar. As soon as they took off the trumot masrot, the chamor ate. And so the Gemara always views that as a paradigm of Hashem's protection of the tzaddikim. Not only will they not be nechshal b'aveira, but not even their animals. So the Gemara uses it in reverse now and says, look, if Hashem protected Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair's chamor, certainly he would protect Rabbi Chanina ben Gamliel from sinning in such a manner. So you can't be saying that he ate something that was asur. Ela, bikshul ha-chilo, davar gadol. Rather, they wanted to feed him, or he almost fed him something that was asur, but not that he actually ate it. Now, the Rabbeinu Tam says here in many places in Shas that Gnai hu l'tzadik she'ochel davar yisur. Rabbeinu Tam narrows the scope of this divine protection to ingesting or eating things that are asur. Because that's a unique feature that when you eat something that's asur, the way the Torah terms it is that you're eating davar tameh. And it's something that causes the person to be defiled and is mitamteh mitalev. And all the descriptors that are used for eating non-kosher and for eating things that are asurim, those unique properties make it something that is more inappropriate, inconceivable, that Hashem would allow such a tzaddik to be nechshal in an aver like this. But it's not a general principle of averot tzaddikim don't do. Tosfot here has a list of instances where we have tzaddikim that make mistakes or do something wrong. So in order to reconcile between them, he says that that's the case. He says even within their family, the protection is not necessarily provided. It's only for the tzaddik himself. Rabbeinu Tam narrows the scope of this concept because it's a davar miguneh. It's something that is considered to be disgusting or unacceptable that he would eat something that is asur, and therefore the Gemara always asks it in context where it's possible that a tzaddik or talmid chacham was going to eat or possibly ate something that was asur. So then, my nihu, what is this davar gadol that he almost ate? Eiver min achai. So it's interesting that it terms davar gadol eiver min achai, likely because eiver min achai is a mitzvah that is not only unique to Jews, but also applies to b'nei noach. It's one of the shiva mitzvahs, b'nei noach, and therefore it's a davar gadol. As Rashi describes over here, that they lost an eiver min ashkuta. They lost one of the limbs or one of the items they were supposed to cook, and they were so scared of him that they didn't want to tell him that they had lost the eiver, that they couldn't find the meat that they were supposed to serve. So they went off and chopped off an eiver min achai to bring it to replace it, and they didn't tell him. Obviously, it came too light before he ate it, but because of the fear that he had instilled in his household, they were too scared to tell him the truth. And being too scared to tell him the truth, the replacement item was something that was a sore because they were just trying to cover up for the problem. And that's what led to this problem or possible issue. And that's what the Gemara is trying to explain over here, that there's a value in commanding and directing your household, but there is also a value in doing that in a manner that is calm and reasonable and pleasant so that they listen to you, firm and pleasant, because that way they will listen to you, but they also will not be too fearful to tell you the truth, because then you'll actually know when something's wrong. If you instill this extreme fear within the house, they'll be too scared to tell you the truth, and then you won't get the answer. You'll always get the answer is yes, because they're too scared to tell you no. In that case, you'll never know the truth, and you'll run yourself into problems. Shalach le Mar Ukva the Rabbi Elazar. So Mar Ukva sends over to Rabbi Elazar. Mar Ukva is found in Bavel. He is a Talmid Chaver of Shmuel in Bavel, so he's the very early Amoraim in Bavel. Rabbi Elazar is a Talmid Chaver of Rabbi Yochanan in Eretz Yisrael. In a way, they're very similar in that if it's Shmuel and Rabbi Yochanan and Eretz Yisrael, Shmuel and Bavel, Mar Ukva and Rabbi Elazar's relationship with these individuals is very similar, that Mar Ukva is like a Talmud Chover of Shmuel and Rabbi Elazar is a Talmud Chover of Rabbi Yochanan. Mar Ukva is having an issue and he sends to Rabbi Elazar to get advice about it. He says, "Bnei Adam omdim alai b'yadi l'masram l'machut." Now, what's the din? He says, I have these individuals that are causing me a lot of problems and a lot of trouble. Am I allowed to give them over to the government officials? Speaking about probably the Roman officials at the time. And he knows that he can give over or he can tell on them to the government and the government will take care of his problem because they're going to cart them away or they're going to prosecute these individuals. What they were doing to him is not clear. Rashi claims over here that most of the advice was Mirivani or Maknitani. That they were fighting with me, they were quarreling with me. It was more verbal abuse than anything else. There are other Rishonim that believe that they were actually causing him serious problems and they were turning him over to the government and that they were malshin on him to the government. That has major nafkaminot in terms of the conclusion of the Gemara here. Sirteit vekatavle. So then he drew lines on the parchment and then wrote to him. This also goes back to yesterday's daf, where if you write a pasuk, and you write more than two or three words out of the pasuk, then you have to be sirteit, you have to put lines over there to write properly. So sirteit v'katavle, Rabbi Elazar writes back to him, quoting a pasuk. Amarti, eshmera dirachai michato. I wanted to watch my ways, protect my ways from sinning. Bilshoni, eshmera lefi machsom. Ba'od rasha l'negdi. That my tongue, I guard, or I put up a block, a stoppage, ba'od rasha l'negdi, when the rasha is still opposite me. So he's hinting to him to hold his tongue. The proper behavior over here is not to take retribution, not to go after them, because the advice in Tehillim is that even when the rasha is opposite you, that you remain silent, and that you accept, and you do not attack the rasha. Afa pisha rasha l'negdi, eshmera lefi machsom. Even though the Rasha is right there and he's causing you problems, you should still remain silent, that you should hold back in those situations. So then, Shalach Lei Kamitzari Li Tuva. So he sends back to them, they're really bothering me. They're really giving me a hard time. Obviously implying that it was even worse than the first time he sent him, and it's very hard for him to hold back over here. Velo Matzina Di Ikumbehu. And I don't think I can hold out anymore. Shalach Lei Dom Lashem V'hit Cholel Lo. You should be silent to Hashem, and then hope for him, meaning that Hashem will take up your battle. So here he adds on the additional aspect here. Not only should you be silent, but your silence will result in Hashem intervening on your behalf. Dom Lashem, v'hu yipileim lecha chalalim chalalim. If you're silent towards Hashem, then he will make them piles and piles of corpses. I translated in the literal way of the pasuk, which is dom means to be silent, like vayidom aharon, that Aaron was silent. But there are many interpretations of the word dom. Over here, you're going to see one of them, which the Gemara says, Hashkem v'harev alehem the Beit HaMidrash, v'hein kalin me'alehem. Get up early and stay late in the Beit Midrash, and they will disappear by themselves. They will self-destruct or be eliminated by themselves. So now, dom, in that case, Tosafot brings the possibility that dom, in that case, means dimdumei chama, rays of the sun, which is a terminology that's used in the Gemara Brachot to reference sunrise and sunset. It means to be there very early and to be there very late. That's one possibility. The other possibility of explaining dom over here means, dom means to give shevach, to give praise to Hashem. That's what it means, dom l'Hashem, means give praise to Hashem and Hashem will handle the situation. Tosafot brings two possibilities about what this means in terms of intervening on his behalf. One possibility is that he should go and daven in the Beit Midrash, and his daven, he should daven that Hashem should take care of the situation or provide the din that's there. Even though the Gemara says in other places, the Gemara in Baba Kama says that even a person should not be moser din al chaveiro. Shnayim Hashem Hashem, to take retribution or bring his fellow Jew to task, because when you ask them to open up his file, then before they do that, they're going to check your file. And therefore, it doesn't bring good things for you when you ask Hashem to take retribution on others. Thus, what it says over here, that's only when the situation is going to be handled otherwise. Meaning that there is a Beit Din Shalmata that will handle the situation and take care of it. But if there's nobody's going to handle it, then you have to ask Hashem to intervene in this case. The other interpretation he brought, which is Hashkem Alem the Beit Midrash Kamar LaSok B'Torah. Just get up early and learn Torah. Stay late and learn Torah. Be more diligent in your Torah study. And V'Heim Kalin Me'Aleim. And maybe here the word Dom then could mean silent, which is that you learn and be silent to this situation. And Dom here would be a reference to Torah, similar to the way that the Paskuk in Yechezkel uses Haneg Dom, that Yechezkel has to remain silent during Avelut. One of the things we learn out from that is that you're not allowed to learn Torah, Divrei Torah, while a person is in Avel. So there the word Dom is used in the context of Divrei Torah. So for that reason, they'll call him Ahem. Davar Yatzah Mipi Rabbi Elazar, V'Nanua L'Gneiva B'Kolar. The word left Rabbi Elazar's mouth, and before it even reached Marukvah, by the time it reached Marukvah, they had already put him into a kolar. A kolar is like a collar, but a chain collar. The government had come and taken him away, basically to be executed by the government. This guy Geneva, who was an individual, as Rashi says, was the Chaya Cholek Alav. He was the guy that was arguing on him. And he was taken away by kolar. He was taken, the government incarcerated him, took him away. In their time, that was a sign that you were, as Rashi calls it, Muhtav the Machut, that you were now a wanted man by the government, and that you were now on alert that you were going to be executed or prosecuted by the government. They used to put a metal collar around the individual's neck to indicate that. I forgot to mention before, what you think the issue is actually has nafka minot alocha. Because if you think that Gneva was actually giving Marukva over to the government and telling on him, that means that the answer of Rabbi Elazar says that even when someone else is malshin on you, you may not be malshin on them. And that's a big issue, which is that even if they're giving you over the government, you can't take retribution by giving them over to the government. Because Rabbi Elazar answers him that despite the fact that he's causing you this problem, and despite the fact of all this trouble, you're not allowed to do this, you have to remain silent in the face of this. On the other hand, according to Rashi's interpretation, that problem over here was a verbal problem, that he was quarreling with him and giving him a hard time, then the only thing you learn from this is that you're not allowed to be machine in a case where there's verbal abuse or there's difficulty with the individual, but implying that had he been machine on you, then you would be allowed to be machine on the other party. And that would be machloket. How you read this sugya has nafkamino to whether you're allowed to give over an individual to the government once they've given you over to the government, they've caused you problems with the government. And that will depend on what you think the difficulty Marukva was facing from Geneva. Right now, Shalchulei the Marukva, Zimra Menalan Dasir. This was a question that was presented to Marukva. Again, Marukva is Av Beit Din. He is a prominent figure in Bavel. Nevertheless, since he was Nogea Badavar in the last case, he sent to Rabbi Elazar, who's a big leader within Eretz Yisrael, to get advice about the situation. He didn't feel that he could answer it on his own, and therefore he sent to Rabbi Elazar. This sugya here actually going to send us back to the last daf in Sota. It's nice chazara to see it again so close after we finish Gemara and Sota, but it's basically all the sugyot that we had seen in that last Mishnah in Sota. It says, Zimra, song, Menalan Dasir. How do we know that it's a sur here post Churban HaBayit? How do we know that it's a sur? So Sirtet V'Katav Lohu, again, referencing yesterday's daf, they drew lines and then he wrote back a pasuk to him. Al Tismach Israel, El Gil Ka'amim. So here in our Gemara it's Ba'amim, but the puzzle really says Ka'amim. B'nei Yisrael should not rejoice like the joy of the other nations. B'lishloach Lohu Mehocha. Gemara says, why did he use that pasuk? Why doesn't he use this pasuk? Bishir lo yishtu yayin, yimar shechar l'shotav. Why didn't he send in the pasuk, which is actually the pasuk that's quoted by the Mishnah at the end of Sota? How do you know that mi batlu Sanhedrin, from the time that the Sanhedrin was batel, that batel shir mi beit ha-mishtaot? The Mishnah quotes this pasuk, bishir lo yishtu yayin. So he said, why didn't he quote the pasuk that's found in the Mishnah in Sota, rather than quote this other pasuk? So he says, Ime'ahahu, had he quoted that pasuk, hava mini hani mili zimra demana. That would have been song that involved musical instruments. Aval de Puma Shari. But that which was just vocal songs would have been mutar. Kamash Malan, that not only is instrumental music asur, but even just vocal song is asur. So now, what it's referencing to here is the same question that we had in the Gemara in Sota, which is that this is not any song that is asur, and music in general that is asur, but rather, first, what is mutar? The Gaonim make it clear that anything that is a song, that's shevach l'Hashem, a hodaya l'Hashem, whether it's giving praise, thanks, or anything that is directed towards Hashem, is mutar. And so therefore, zmirot of those nature are clearly mutar, and it's not under this restriction. Also, music or vocals to be mitzameh techatan bekala, which are music of mitzvah, that too is mutar. And the other thing that is mutar is music that is done to help a person work. But that means to concentrate on their work or to keep a certain rhythm in their work. That's also mutar. All of those we saw in the Gemara in Sota. Now, here, what is asur is, first of all, many point out that it says ka'amim, which means like the other nations, which means secular music or music of the other nations. That is what is asur. So if one is simply just listening to that music for pleasure, that would be inappropriate in the context of Churban HaBayit to listen to that music. It's not in the context of a mitzvah. It's not in the context of praising Hashem. And that music would be problematic. In addition, obviously, music of Pritzut or Hololut would clearly be asur. So where exactly the line is, it's not clear, but certain things are obviously mutar, and certain things are obviously asur. Some things that are on the borderline where you'd have to clarify, and that's where the halacha and the poskim speak about are those things on the line. The other interesting thing over here is that here when you have music, he does not differentiate between instrumental music and vocal music, which is, I think, popular today that many people suggest that even though certain types of music are asur, that a cappella or certain types of singing would be mutar in the face of where there are restrictions against instrumental music. Over here, he does not make a differentiation like that, and seemingly that they would be equated then. That instrumental music and these vocal music would be equated in that sense, and therefore it may be just as asur in places where there are restrictions against listening to music, that both of them should be asur. Amalei Rav Huna bar Natan Rav Ashi. Mai dichtiv. What is meant by the psukim in Yoshua? In Yoshua, there is delineating these cities that are belonging to each shevet. And most of the time, the cities are border cities. So it's delineating the borders of the shvatim. So over there, in the cities or borders of Yehuda, in Yoshua, it says, Vikina, Vidimona, Vaad Ada. So here it lists three cities. Rav Huna bar Natan is asking Rav Ashi, what are these? Amalei, Mitavato, Da Eretz Yisrael Kochoshiv. It's telling you the borders of Eretz Yisrael. So Amalei, Ata Analo Yadana, De Mitavato, Da Eretz Yisrael Kochoshiv. I didn't know that. I know how to read Psukim. I know that these are border cities over there. Ella, and now he's going to go on to give a more agadic interpretation of these cities. The question of why he even asked the question, what's bothering him about the cities over here, is not clear. There's a large list there of 35 cities, and all of a sudden he picks three out of the 35 cities. The question might come up is because at the end of the Perek by Yoshua, when it's describing these borders, it says that these are the 29 cities. Yet if you look in the Pirut, there are 35 of them. So there are six cities that are mentioned there that are not incorporated in the 29 cities that are included in Yehuda. So the Mefreshei Navi over there explained that is because, and this happens in many times, we actually have it here in Beit Shemesh, which is that when you have a city that is the border between two Shvatim, Beit Shemesh shot at the border between Dan and Yehuda, then the city is sometimes enumerated in both Shvatim. So there the Mishnayim talk about the fact that either it would belong to Shimon, or these were cities that were border cities that were shared between the two Shvatim. It might have belonged to the other Shevet, but it's enumerated just to give you the delineation of the border of Yehuda. So that's Al Piyach Shat. But here he has Al Piyach Gada. What are these cities doing there? So he says, El Rav Gvia Margiza Amar Bataimo. So Rav Gvia Margiza interpreted these words. And now he says, Koshiesh Lo Kina Al Chaveiro. Anybody who has a beef with his friend, meaning he has an issue with his friend, Vidomeim, and remains silent, Shochein Adei Ad Oselo Din. The one who dwells forever will take care of his din. Now all these are, you see, it plays on the word. It says bikina. So kina here comes from the word kina. Dimona is from like the word domain. And then ba'ad ada is like from shochein ade ad. Play on the words is here, someone who has an issue with his friend, if he remains silent, Hashem will take up the issue on his behalf. Samarlei, elameato. Ravashi says back to him, then what are you going to do with vitsiglag, umad mana, visansana? Again, so he picks another three cities in a row and asks, what's going on with those three cities? The reason here now might be the total of cities. Now you have a six. Six is the differential between the enumerated cities in the list and the 29 that are mentioned at the end of the list. And so that might be why they picked these six as being cities that they wanted to interpret. So he says back to him, Hochanami, what are you going to tell me there? What type of interpretation? I'm like, you're asking me? I don't do these types of agadic interpretations, but have Rav Gevira been here? He would have handled the situation. He would have told you a nice agadic interpretation. But then Rav Acham ben Chozah amar ba hachi. So now Rav Acham ben Chozah steps in and says, I'll explain it. Kol mi sheyesh lo tzakat ligima al chaveiro, someone who has an issue with his friend. Rashi over here said tzakat ligima. Ligima is usually a terminology that's used for food or mizonot, that he says that this is someone that is yoreid le mizonotav. This is someone that's causing him problems, not just verbal or difficulties, but literally is causing him to be impoverished, taking away his parnasa, causing him serious issues, vidomein, and is silent, shochein b'sne oselo din. Then the one who dwells in the sne will take care of his din. So now again, you can see the words playing. Tziklag is a play on sakat legima. Omad mana is a play again on domain. And sansana is a play on sne. So that's the agadic interpretation. Seemingly the difference between this and the previous case is the severity by which he's being attacked by the other party. In the other instance, it was simply kina. So causing him problems, causing quarrels or difficulties for the individual. Over here is yoreid lemizonotav, that he's really going after his livelihood, his ability to live. So the siman that is given is the nature of Hashem who's going to respond. Before it was the shochein adayad, the great Hashem will respond. Over here is the Shem of the Sneh that will respond. And if you remember, we're coming up on Parshat Shmot, the Shem and the Sneh, what is the imagery of Hashem and the Sneh? Is that, Imo Anochi Bitzara, that I am with them in their pain. Meaning that Hashem says, take care of those that are downtrodden. I take care of those that are in difficult situations, like the Jews are enslaved in Egypt. And so the Shochein B'Sneh represents Hashem who protects those whose livelihood is being compromised by these individuals. And that's why the imagery of Hashem is different here than in the previous case. Amlei Reish Galuto L'Rav Huna. Klila Manalon D'Asur. How do we know that a Klila is Asur? Again, I told you this is Chazara from the Gemara at the end of Sota, which is, how do you know that a crown is Asur? That's what Rashi says over here. Klila Hayu Osim Atarot D'Chatanim. Rashi translates Atarot literally as a crown, that they used to make a wreath of some sort or a crown that they put on top of the heads of the chatan and the kala. Tosafot over here takes issue with Rashi's explanation and says that he doesn't think that is correct because the way that it's described at the end of the Gemara and Sota doesn't leave open the possibility that you're really talking about a literal crown on the head of the individual, but rather he says it's a kippah. Ke'en kippah, uberosh kol adam. He says it's a type of kippah that's put above everybody's head. Now it's not clear when Tosafot says here kippah. The word kippah can be used in two ways. A kippah can be used like we use it today as a kippah, which means some sort of head covering or larger head covering. A kippah is also used to describe an arch way or a dome. So therefore the kippah over here was more like a chuppah or a crown in the sense of not directly on the head, but something that enveloped them in terms of the decorative chuppah or area around them. So Tosafot says it was more extensive. Whatever this was, it was a kippah and not an atara, like Rashi describes as a crown over here. So klila milalan d'asur, malei midrabanan. So Rav Huna, who is a Talmid Chacham or a leader in the generation, was associated with the Reish Galuta, the exilarch. They're asking him halachic questions. They're asking him, where is the source of the fact that you can't have this in a wedding anymore? He says to them, it's a din d'rabanan. Which is true. The Mishnah in Sota tells us these were takanot chachamim that were associated with the Churban HaBayit or different stages of the Churban HaBayit. Meditnan. The Mishnah there says, Bepumos fel asfanios gazuel atarot chatanim v'alei irus. In the battles with Vespasian, they were gozer on the atarot chatanim v'alei irus. Atarot Chatanim, which is what we're describing over here, whether that's literally a crown of the Chatan, or whether that is some sort of covering over the Chatan and Kala. Vala Irus, Irus we saw already in the Gemara and Sota, refers to an instrument. Rashi over there describes it as a bell of sorts. Tosafot over here says that it's a one-sided drum, the Irus that they restricted. Here he gives them the source for the fact that this is the reason behind which you can't have these items. So now Rashi over here, interestingly enough, when it says Pumul Shel Asfanius, he says Chayol Shel Asfanius Kodem Shabbat Titus Aleihem. It is the army that was brought by Vespasian before Titus came. And we know the story, this can be later on in Gittin, that Vespasian basically wages most of the battle in what they call the Mered HaGadol, which leads to the Churban HaBayit, starting about 67 after the Common Era, that lasts until roughly 70, 71 when the Churban HaBayit takes place. Vespasian is the leader of those armies in that battle, but then he's recalled to Rome to become the emperor after the suicide of Nero, and then there's a year of a couple of emperors and anarchy that exists in Rome until the finally the Senate appoints Vespasian as the emperor and he comes back to Rome. He leaves behind Titus, Titus who likely is his son, he leaves behind to wage or continue the battle, and as described later on in the Gemara in Kitin, Titus is the one who executes on the Churban HaBayit and finally quells what we call the Mered HaGadol in Eretz Yisrael. Here Rashi describes Vespasian and Titus in this manner, versus the difficulty that we have with Rashi's explanation in the Gemara and Sota, that Titus somehow was associated with Aristobulus and Hyrcanus in the Greek era of the Hasmonaic dynasty. Over here you see Rashi connecting Vespasian and Titus more along of the historical reality as well as what the Gemara in Gittin says. So now it says here, Amalei Rav Chista, so now, Adachi Kam Rav Huna Lafnuye. So in the meantime, Rav Huna left the room because he had to relieve himself. He went to the took a bathroom break. So Amalei Rav Chista. So Rav Chista pipes up all of a sudden. Why does Rav Chista pipe up? Because Rav Chista is a Talmud of Rav Huna. So while Rav Huna was there, Rav Chista would not speak because his Rebbe was there, he would not answer. But once his Rebbe left, Rav Chista pipes up and says, Kroktiv, it's a pasuk. Komar Hashem Elukim, Hasir Hamitznefet, Varim Atara. Remove your hat and take off your crown. Zot, lo zot. Not this, not that. Hashafala hagbeya. That which is downtrodden will be uplifted. Vahagavoa hashpil. And that which was high up will be knocked down or taken down. He says, V'chima inyan mitznefet etzel atara. What is the correlation or the connection between a mitznefet and an atara? Elolomar lecha. Bizmancha mitznefet berosh koin gadol. When the mitznefet is on the head of the Kohen Gadol, atara berosh kol adam. Then there's a crown on the regular lay people. Yistalka mitznefet merosh Kohen Gadol. When there's no longer a mitznefet on the head of the Kohen Gadol, meaning there's no longer a Kohen Gadol doing avoda in the Mikdash because of the Churban HaBayit. Yistalka atara merosh kol adam. Then you remove the crown from above the heads of anyone else. Referencing obviously what they speak over here, the kilat chatanim that he's referencing over here. So the drosha is the hekesh between mitznefet and atara. What is the correlation? Mitznefet being the word for hat, but also has a very particular meaning, which is the mitznefet refers to the hat of the Kohen Gadol. That is brought here in the Balei HaTosafot to mention this both here and in the Gemara and Yoma, that the difference between the hat of the Kohen Gadol and the hat of a Kohen Hedyot is that Kohen Hedyot's hat is called a mikbat, and the hat of the Kohen Gadol is called a mitznefet. The difference being that the mikbat was a much larger hat than the mitznefet. It might have been also that it was flatter. But the reason being because the Kohen Gadol had to wear tzitz and tefillin with his mitznefet. Therefore, he needed a smaller hat to allow for the room for the headband of the tzitz and the tefillin on top so that he had a smaller hat on top. The great Kohen Hedyot, who didn't necessarily have to wear his hat when he had his tefillin on and didn't wear a tzitz, his hat could be bigger and cover more space because he didn't have to allow for that extra room. That's a description given here by Tosafot, and he says that's the reason that the Kohen Gadol's hat is called a mitznefet, and the Kohen Hedyot's hat is called a mikbat. On the other hand, the Ri says that this is not a definitive line where the word mitznefet is only used to describe the hat of a Kohen Gadol, because he says in the parlance of the Mishnah, in Yoma, you see that the mitznefet is used to describe the hats of the Kohenim Hedyotim, because it talks about there the lottery in the morning. And they used to count to figure out who would win the lottery in the morning to do the avoda. It says that they used to take off the mitznefet from the hat, from the head of the Kohen, and then start to count, so he knew where he started from. But there it's talking about the Kohenim Hedyotim, and it says mitznefet. So he says, at least maybe in the parlance of the Torah, Mitznefet refers to the Kohen Gadol and Mikvat. But he says it's not case necessarily in Chazal or in the Gemara when they use the word Mitznefet that it automatically means that it's talking about the Kohen Gadol. Over here it makes sense because, first of all, it's used in the Tanakh, the word Mitznefet, so that means that it's probably referencing the Kohen Gadol, as well as the fact that the Kohen Gadol, who is the leader and the spiritual guide of Bnei Israel, is considered to be the holiest and greatest individual in terms of the spiritual realm, the Chatan is compared to him. And so Tosafot over here brings the Midrash that a Chatan is like a Kohen Gadol, who's a Rosh Besar B'Yisrael. Similar Midrashim that we see in other places, that the Chatan is like a Melech, but that the Chatan has a unique standing that is of an elevated status on the day of his wedding, and therefore it makes sense to compare the Chatan to a Mitznevet, to the Kohen Gadol in this context. Adahochi Adaravuna. In the meantime, now that Rav Chista piped up while his Rebbe was out of the room, Rav Huna comes back from his bathroom break. Ashkechinu Dave Yatve. He sees them sitting down. Amalei Helukim Midrabanan. He says, I'm telling you, Bishvua, it's a Din Derabanan. The way that Rav Chista is presenting it, it's a Pasuk in Tanakh. So then maybe it's a Din Nevi'im. It's a much earlier institution than a Din Chachamim. So Rav Huna says, I'm telling you that it's Helukim Midrabanan. Elechista Shimcha. Your name is Chista. V'chizdayin Milach. And you say nice things. You have a nice interpretation of the Pasuk, but it might be a hint to what you're saying, but in reality, that's not the source for this. That might be, we'll call it an Asmachta, but the real reason for it is the Mishnah in Sotah that clearly states that the Klilat Chatanim was eliminated because of a Tekanat Chachamim, not necessarily because of this Pasuk. Then you have to explain what the Pashtut of Pasuk is. Part of that might have to do with that it's talking about Bayit Rishon and not Bayit Sheni. I mean, obviously, they're speaking here. When they talk about the Mishnah in Sotah, that's a reference to Bayit Sheni. When you're talking about Pulmoshel Asphanius and Pulmoshel Titus, these are all parts of the Churban Bayit Sheni. The Pasuk in Yechezkel is clearly talking about the Churban Bayit HaRishon, a time in which the Kohen Gadol will return, meaning that the Kuna returns in the Bayit Sheni. And so therefore, you might not want to interpret it to mean Mitznefet here to refer to the Kohen Gadol, or you might want to refer to the Tarat, to the king. Meaning that at the time that the Kohen Gadol is Batel, so will the monarchy of Israel be eliminated. And that makes sense at the time of Bayit Rishon, that Tzidkiyahu HaMelech is put into Galut at the Churban HaBayit at the same time that the Churban HaBayit takes place. And that's what he's saying, that the monarchy will not survive the Churban HaBayit. And that's maybe the reference in Yechezkel, the Pashtut reference, rather than the interpretation Rav Chista brings. Alright, so it's interesting. How did Rav Huna know? So either he came back and he heard them discussing it when he came back, that seems to be what's implied here. I thought, I didn't see this anywhere, that Ashkechinu Dave Yatve, he saw them sitting down. Which is interesting because technically, Rav Huna, when he re-entered the room, they might have had to stand up for him because he was his Rebbe, and Rav Chista should have gotten up. The fact that they remained sitting when he came back to the room seems to indicate that now they had accepted Rav Chista maybe being a peer of Rav Huna's because he now gave this interpretation and he was speaking up where he hadn't spoken up before. And so then they accorded Rav Chista a certain amount of honor in front of his Rebbe Rav Huna they wouldn't have done before. But now that Rav Chista had spoken up, when they were Yatve, they were sitting, that was an indication that Rav Chista must have said something that garnered him a certain amount of kavod. So I don't know if that was the indication or simply that he walked in on the conversation.
All right, so just adding an additional perspective on maybe why
this indicated to Rav Huna that something had taken place.
Ravina Ashkechen Amar Baravashi, Dava Godil Klila Librate. Ravina finds Mar Baravashi that he was braiding, twining, twisting a crown for his daughter, a Klila for his daughter. Again, according to Rashi, that literally means some sort of wreath or crown that went on the daughter's head. Whereas for Tosafot, it means that he was making some sort of covering or kippah that they would put on top of the Kala. Amalei Lo Savar Lamar. Don't you hold of the interpretation of the Pasuk, Hasir, a Mitznefet of Harim, Hatara, that there's this correlation between the Mitznefet and the Hatara and that the Klila, or these Atarot, or Asurim, post the Churban. Amalei, Dumia de Kohen Gadol. Similar to the Kohen Gadol, Begavre, who's a man. Aval Menashe, Lo.
By women, that's not the case. I mentioned this when we discussed this in the Gemara and Sotah, that it's clear that both of them get affected by the Takana. But the Takana versus the Chatanim is it's eliminated completely, and that's the din of Levi there in the Gemara in Sotah. As opposed to Klilat Kala, which over there, the Gemara just simply says they downgraded the Klilat Kala, which is that they didn't allow the Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, or the Atarot Zahav, that you can't do these fancy gold types of crowns, but if you use something that's more simple, that they allowed it. And there we discussed it. Basically, there's a key difference between a man and a woman, and that's true in general, in that the clothing of a woman, the dressing up of the woman, her beauty is much more important to her, and therefore eliminating it entirely, the Chachamim did not feel right to do or appropriate to do in that case. And therefore, the woman remained having the ability to have a klila, but just a downgraded klila. On the other hand, for the men, they eliminated the klila entirely, because again, the difference between men and women is obvious over here. So now the Gemara goes back to the remainder of the pasuk and says, "My zot lo zot, this not this." So Darash Rav Ira, Zimnin Amalei Mishmei Deravami, Zimnin Amalei Mishmei Deravasi. Sometimes he says it over in the name of Ravami, sometimes in the name of Ravasi. B'shash Amar Kodesh Baruch Yisrael Asir Hamitznefet Varim Atara. Amru Malachei Asherei Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ribono Shel Olam Zot Lahem LeYisrael Shiktimu Lefanecha B'Sinai Naseh LeNishma. This is the retribution. This is how you're going to treat Bnei Yisrael, who said Naseh LeNishma Har Sinai, you special, unique nation. How could it be that this is what the end is going to be for them? The Churban HaBayit and the downgrading of their stature. Amlem Lo Zot Lahem LeYisrael. Aren't they deserving of this? Because they took down that which was great, and they elevated that which was downtrodden. So that's the remainder of the pasuk. Obviously, that they're darshan over here. And they put idol worships in the idol worship, or they brought idols into the heichal. And that Avodah Zarah had taken over. They took that which was the lowly thing, the Avodah Zarah, and elevated it. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu was the high thing they denigrated. And actually, this style of interpretation is actually used in the keynote that we say on Tisha B'Av, which is a play on words like zot or ko, where the Baal HaKinah brings something that is ko, which is positive, and then Hashem responds with something ko, which is negative, which is that the Baal HaKinah says, how could this happen to Klal Yisrael, who did this or had this, using a pasuk or a reference to a specific word, verb ko, and then the Hashem or the response is that, well, how could I not do this to them because of ko, what they did? A similar style to which is used here in the Gemara is used in some of the keynote that we see on Tisha B'Av of contrasting different aspects of the beauty and the emunah and faithfulness that Bnei Yisrael had to Hashem, contrasting that with the Churban HaBayit, and the response being that Bnei Yisrael acted unfaithfully and in a debased manner, and therefore they are deserving of that. How could I not cause the Churban to happen? So a very similar style of drasha is used in some of the keynote that you say on Tisha B'Av. Darash Rav Avira, Zimnin Amalei Mishmei Adravami, Zimnin Amalei Mishmei Adravasi. Again, a similar refrain over here, which is here you have a drasha from Avira. Sometimes he says it from Ravami, sometimes from Ravasi. Mai dichtiv, what is meant by the pasuk? Ku amar Hashem, im shlemim, v'chein rabim, v'chein nagozu, v'avar. So the pashtut of pasuk is, ku amar Hashem, im shlemim, if they be quiet, v'chein rabim, or many, v'chein nagozu, they will be cut down, v'avar, when Hashem passes by. V'initich, lo ani chod, and though I've afflicted you now, I will afflict you no more, I will not continue to afflict you. So that's the pashtut of pasuk. Imro adam shemizonotav mitzumtzamim, if a person sees that his parnasa is limited, or his means of attaining mizonot are impaired somehow, yasemehen staka, v'koshkein shehen mirubim, he should do staka with them, and in doing staka with them, that will increase or take care of him. And certainly the cases where he has lots of parnasa, he definitely should do staka. Mai v'chein nagozu v'avar, what is the imagery here of nagozu v'avar, that you should streamline them and then they'll be able to pass? Tana debe Rabbi Shmuel, kol gozeis minichasav, v'sei mehen staka. Anyone who shears of his possessions and does staka with them, nitzal midina shel gehinom, he'll be saved from the din of gehinom. Mashal, what is this similar to? Let me give you a parable of sorts. The shtei rechelot sheyu ovrot b'mayim. You have two ewes that are crossing over the water. Achat gezuza, v'achat eni gezuza. One of them is sheared, one of them is not sheared. Gezuza avra, the one that was sheared made it across because they were not bogged down by the weight of their shearings that got wet, which would become extremely heavy. Sheina gezuza lo avra, but the one who was heavy and laden could not cross because they sunk by the weight of the water and the shearings. So what you learn from here is that the way to preserve oneself and to ensure that one has mizonot is to do gziza, do a shearing. What is the shearing that is being referenced to over here is the taking off, tithing, giving tzedakah from one's possessions. That is the shearing that we were representing. Now, how do they learn this from the pasuk? Omar Hashem im shleimim. Rashi over here says the word shleimim is mitzum tzamim. V'achi karma makra. Im shleimim mizonotayich. Kol shekeinim rabim. So shleimim, Rashi says, comes with the word to be mitzum tzam, limited, whole. The word shalem, in that case, whole, means that's all that you have. All you have is this limited amount of mizonot. Here, whole being everything that you have, not whole being like, wow, shalem, I have everything I need. So when you have this limited amount of mizonot, what should you do? V'chei nagozu. You do a gziza, you do a shearing. What is a shearing? You should give tzedakah, you should eliminate from some of it, give it away, and then vavar, then things will pass, and you will be rewarded with a mizonot or greater rewards. And then the kosukim, the Gemara continues with the pasuk, it says, v'initich, means continuation of the pasuk, amar mazutra, afilo ani amit pranes min tzedakah, yaseh tzedakah. That even someone who is supported by the community and gets his money from charity, he himself should give charity from his charity that he receives. Lo aaniach od, I will no longer afflict you. Tani Rav Yosef, shuv emarin lo simanei aniyut. That an individual acts in this way will no longer be impoverished. So somebody who's impoverished and then has to lean on the community to get charity, if he still gives charity out of that which he gets, then Hashem promises him that lo anitich, I no longer will afflict you, meaning that you no longer be burdened by this poverty. So here you see a prescription over here about how a person should act in order to ensure that they have mizonot. Again, this seems counterintuitive, and that's why the drush is so important. One would think that if they hoard and that they save money, then they'll have more. And that's the exact opposite of what the pasuk is indicating or the drush is indicating. It's saying here that the more that you give away, the more that you have. And so that's the difficulty. I mean, the human difficulty here is, it seems that it won't work. If I give away more of my money, how am I going to have more? In the end, I have less. And that's the promise from Hashem, that if you expend on tzedakah, if you take care of others, then Hashem will reward you with more and return you many fold that which you give. And that's what the pasuk says, or the drasha says, aser ta'aser, aser kedei shetitasher. That one should give up masrot, because giving up tithes, which seemingly reduces what you have, in the end, gives you more, because that is me'asher, that Hashem promises you will get bountiful crops from taking off the masrot. And the Gemara there brings stories of individuals who used to tithe from the fields, and when they tithed from the fields and gave generously, the fields were bountiful and produced a lot. And afterwards, the person who took it and decided that it wasn't worth giving up all these tithes, then the fields gave 1/10 of the produce that they gave before. That's the same idea, aser to aser, that if you don't give your maaser, I'm going to make it that you have eser or isur. You're going to have only 1/10 of what you had before. Again, two sides of the same coin, which is giving will beget more, and withholding will beget less. And that's the idea conveyed by the pasuk over here. All right, now, the Gemara goes back to the Mishnah, and in the Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda starts to give you borders of Eretz Yisrael in the Mishnah. It says, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Mirekem LeMizrach. So one of the borders that's given in the Mishnah, according to Rabbi Yehuda, is Akko is Mitzafon. Akko is the northern border, and then Akko is considered to be outside of Eretz Yisrael. The Gemara here is going to challenge that Akko is in the Tzafon. The Memra, the Akko, the Tzafon, the Eretz Yisrael, Kayama, that makes it sound like Akko is in the northern part of Eretz Yisrael, Viriminhu. The Gemara here quotes a Tosefta. It's very difficult. You can already see there's an Ot Aleph from the Gra. The way that our Gemara quotes the Tosefta is the exact opposite of how the Tosefta appears in the Tosefta. The Gra notes that already Tosafot also says Hachi Garsinim B'Tosefta. He changes the Girsa and the Tosefta. A lot of that has to do with your understanding of where Akko is, which is, we know that Akko is a port city on the western side of Eretz Yisrael. The way that our Gemara describes it over here, and Rashi makes that clear, is that the way that our Gemara describes it is that Akko is a northeastern, seemingly, border town for Eretz Yisrael, not a northwestern border town for Eretz Yisrael, and that is caused by the difference in the Girsa, the way that you quote the Tosefta, which is, Hayam Aleich Me'Akko L'Ksiv. If a person is walking from Akko to Ksiv, Akko is, again, a northwestern port city. If you go north of Akko, Ksiv is north of Akko. Then, Mimino L'Mizracha Derech, on the right side, which is the eastern side of the road, Tmeya, Mishum Eretz Amim. That's considered to be Chutz Laretz.
Those areas are not, are considered to be chutz laaretz, so they don't have any of the mitzvot hatzvuyot laaretz. Therefore, they're patur from aser and patur from shvi'it, from shmita. Ad shivada lecha shehi chayevet. Until it makes known to you that you are chayevet. The assumption, the default status of items on the eastern side of this border are considered to be chutz laaretz. On the other hand, mismolo, that which is on the left, marava, derech to the western side of the road, tehora, is considered tehora mishum eretz amin, because it is eretz Yisrael. And then that is considered to be chayav in mitzvot hatzuyot v'aretz, in masrot and shvi'it, until you have information to the contrary. Ad heichan, how far is this true? Ad ksiv, until you reach ksiv. Rabbi Shmuel b'Rabbi Yossi Omer, mishum aviv, ad lav levo. It goes up until lav levo. He's telling you the length of this borderline. It's not from Akko until Ksiv, but rather from Akko until Lav Levo. So now, the way that Rashi interprets it here, you can see Rashi saying this, that it only makes sense to say this if you're talking about the eastern border of Eretz Yisrael. The eastern border of Eretz Yisrael, that which is the east, is outside of Eretz Yisrael. That which is the west is inside of Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, Rashi locates Akko and Ksiv on the northeastern side based on our Gemara, because that's what it seemingly the Gemara is interpreting over here. If you go to the core Gisra of the Tosefta, you get another view of this, which is, the Tosefta says the exact opposite. It says that which is on the west is considered to be Chutz Laaretz, and that which is on the east is considered to be Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, what you would do is you'd locate Akko on the coastline, and Ksiv is north of Akko on the coastline. It's a little off the coast, Ksiv. And then what you do, if you draw a line from Akko up to Ksiv, the western side is considered to be not Eretz Yisrael, which is there's a strip along the coast that does not belong to Eretz Yisrael, and is considered to be Eretz Amin. But that which is to the east is Eretz Yisrael. So there was this small strip of land that went up the northwestern coast of Eretz Yisrael that was considered not to be Eretz Yisrael, did not have Kedushat Haaretz. And again, that would make a lot of sense because during the time of the Shivat Zion and Bayit Sheni, the Jews had a very difficult time in terms of having port access. That the Chashmonaim were really locked in terms of Yehuda, and they did not have ports. Part of what? Shimon, Amakabi, and then later his son, Yochanan, Hurkunus, later do is they expand the extent of the Chashmonaim, and part of their battles that are along the coastline to open up ports for the Chashmonaim, and helps out the Jews in Eretz Yisrael tremendously by opening up the trade and the ports to them. So you could understand why there might be a strip of land that at the time of Shivat Zion was not considered to be Eretz Yisrael, but rather Eretz Amin, because they didn't have control over those areas. Very clear that the borders that we're discussing over here in the Mishnah, as we mentioned before, talking about Bayit Sheni and Bayit Rishon, they clearly conquered many of these areas. Talking about Shivat Zion in the time of Babel. I also noted in the time that it's very somewhat difficult in the Rambam, because the Rambam quotes these as the borders of Eretz Yisrael, seemingly referencing to Olei Mitzrayim. And therefore, it's hard to understand what the Rambam is doing with our Mishnah, talking about borders that are Olei Mitzrayim, that seemingly are much smaller than that which is described in the Torah and the Nevi'im. So now, those are the two interpretations. Why the Tosefta gives you two directions, meaning saying to the right, which is east, to the left, which is west. It's obvious when you're walking north, and we're talking about a line that goes from Akko to Ksiv, what's on your right is east, and what's on your left is west. Why does the Tosefta give you both items? So Tosfot already raises the issue, and mentions the fact, the possibility that the road moves and turns. So generally, the road is a northern moving road, so yes, to the right is to the east, to the left is west. But sometimes the road turns, and so therefore it's moving east-west or west-east, and therefore they use right and left of the road to indicate to you that it's not always east and west. Generally, it's east and west, but even when places where it's not east and west, the right and left are the determining factors. So the road itself, it's unclear from the Gemara here, and the Rishonim argue about what the status of the road is. Whether the road is considered to be inside or outside, or is it a borderline that runs right up the middle of the road? So those are the three possibilities, and the Rishonim bring up all of those possibilities. So then, Amar Abayir, Ritzua Nafko. It was a small strip that went out. The way that Rashi describes it over here, which again follows our Gemara, versus the interpretation of the Tosefta, if you read it the other way, but in both cases you're going to end up with the same end game, which is that it's a Ritzah. A small strip extends out. So Rashi says a small strip, like a finger-like strip, extends outward, which is part of Eretz Yisrael. And that's what Rabbi says is being described over here, that we're talking about the northeastern border of Eretz Yisrael. And then there's a strip that goes up north
that it is also a part of Eretz Yisrael. So if you have the other interpretation of the Tosefta, then Ritzua is a finger-like projectile that is not Eretz Yisrael that goes up. But either way, what Abaye is suggesting over here is that we're talking about a narrow strip of land that is finger-like projectile that's going up. Whether you read it as being inside of Eretz Yisrael like Rashi does, and the Ramban and many others read it, or whether you read it like the Tosefta, like the Gra and the Tosafot that's referencing on the coastline, it's an area that's not Eretz Yisrael, but it's a finger-like projectile. So Gemara says about that, Vayayiv Tana Simona Hochi, the Tana is going to use a siman like this. Machloket Rashi and Tosafot, what the problem with the siman is. Rashi over here says the problem is, Mi chashivi chadiritzua letnuchei Tana Simona Allah. A little projectile like this, the Tana is going to bother to tell you all this information about a small piece of land, opposed to a large tract of land. Here, it's like a small thing. What's the big deal about it? Why are you going to discuss this? Why is it making a big deal about it? Tosfot does not like the explanation for a very simple reason. It makes a difference. There are halachic ramifications, no matter what the size is, there are halachic ramifications as to whether it is Eretz Yisrael or not Eretz Yisrael. So Tosfot says the Gemara's question is not about why the Tana is telling us about this place, but rather how he demarcates it. He demarcates it based on a path or a road that goes between two locations. When do you ever use a road as a border? That's not something that is large or an easy way to demarcate borders. Why would you ever use a road as the siman? Gemara says, in kra nami ayv simana. The pasuk does the same thing and gives a siman in the same way. So for Rashi, that means that the pasuk tells you about a small strip of land that it's describing. According to Tosafot, it means that the Navi gives you a description of a location based on a road. It gives you its reference point vis-a-vis a road. So you see that the Navi uses that. It says in Shoftim, this is in the end of the story of Pelegish B'Givah, brings us back around to the beginning of the Gemara by Pelegish B'Givah. It says there, V'emiru hinei chag Hashem b'shilo miyamim yamima. So here they're discussing the issue that happened with Bnei Binyamin. Shevet Binyamin is almost completely wiped out. And now they don't know what to do with Shevet Binyamin. There are a certain amount of men that survived the battles. And now they need to get them married in order to save Shevet Binyamin. The problem is that they made a promise together that they would not give any of their children over to Shevet Binyamin. So they saw a part of the problem because of Yavesh Gilad. Yavesh Gilad was not present at the time of the Shvuah. And the tribes then go and wipe out Yavesh Gilad. Yavesh Gilad is a city that comes up numerous times and is very sympathetic to Binyamin. It has strong connections to Binyamin, the most famous of which is, right, they're the ones who get the bodies of Shaul and Yonatan back. David praises the people of Yavesh Gilad for doing that. Shaul had protected them early on in his reign from attack. It's not contiguous necessarily with the Shevet Binyamin. It's on the Evar Yardain. Whether it actually connects to Shevet Binyamin's property on the other side of Yardain is not clear, but they're clearly on the other side of Yardain and sympathetic to Shevet Binyamin. So it would explain why they didn't show up when everybody else came to fight against Binyamin. It would explain why Yavesh Gilad does not show up to fight. Later, what they do is place a cherem on the city of Yavesh Gilad and they kill out the entire city, except for the young women. So those young women that are left over, who are not under the cherem not to give children to Bnei Binyamin, they give them as wives to the Binyamin. But they see that that doesn't suffice. They don't have enough women for all the men of Binyamin. So what they suggest they do is that they go up to this celebration, which seems to be a wine harvest celebration in Shiloh that happens yearly, and that they should go there and the women dance in the field and they should pick for themselves wives from the women of the field. So the Shvatim will be complicit in allowing them and taking the women, but they will not be giving over their daughters to Bnei Binyamin. They'd be taking them themselves. So that was the solution to the problem. So now the Navi in Shoftim describes where this place is located. Where is Shiloh located? The problem being that Shiloh is destroyed in the beginning of Shmuel Aleph. So Shiloh no longer extant. So when the Navi in Shoftim is writing this, meaning that the Gemara in Bava Batra says Shoftim was penned by Shmuel, a Navi. So by the time Shmuel is penning Shoftim, Shiloh doesn't exist. So he's trying to describe to you where Shiloh is when Shiloh doesn't exist. It's not a big city. So what does he say? Asher mitzvona the Beit El. It's north of Beit El. Mizracha Hashemesh lemisila. East of the road that runs over there. Ha'olami Beit El Shchema. That goes from Beit El to Shchem. Uminegev Lilivona, and south of Livona. So here you're talking about, actually today, it's the modern day road that runs between Ramallah and Shechem. The road that runs directly between Ramallah and Shechem, that is the road that they're speaking about. It goes up from Beit El towards Shechem. On that road, being north of Beit El, obviously, south of Shechem, and south of Livona, on the eastern side, to the east of that is Shiloh. And that's the location of Shiloh.
But what do you see here? He's referencing Shiloh vis-a-vis a mesila, a road. So you see that the Tanakh does use that. Now, if that's for Tosfot's explanation, they use a reference point as a road. For Rashi, it's describing you this like small projectile, as he draws in the pictures over here, that Shiloh is this like little area that shoots off the road. Now, what's important about this is that Shiloh is not on the main road. And this becomes a significant issue when they put up Pesel Micha. When Pesel Micha is set up, which is a problem that's mentioned at the end of Shoftim as well, close to the story of Pilegesh B'Givah, Pesel Micha is actually set up along the main road. So anybody who's traveling on the road doesn't have to go anywhere to worship Pesel Micha, because Pesel Micha is along the main road. What's clear here from the description that Shiloh is off the road. And then if you want to go to Shiloh and the Mishkan in Shiloh, you have to make a concerted effort. You have to leave the road and go to Shiloh. Now, for obvious reasons, that's a good thing, right? Which is that we don't want people just because they're on the road to go to Shiloh. We want people to make an active decision to go to Shiloh. But when you put Pesel Micha on the road, which becomes much easier to go to, then it becomes that it replaces Shiloh. People start going to Pesel Micha, which is convenient, rather than going to Shiloh. And again, eventually Shiloh is destroyed. But that description here is brought at the end of Shoftim in the story of Pelegesh B'Givah. From Arav Papa, Mizracha Shel Mesila. What's been described over here is something east of the road that runs between Beit El and Shechem. Gemara continues, Tani Chada, mevi get bespina, ki mevi be'eretz Yisrael. If you bring a get in a boat, it's like bringing it in Eretz Yisrael. Batani idach. We have another bright that says, ki mevi be'chutz laretz. It's like you're bringing it in the chutz laretz. So why is it when you're in a boat, seemingly what Rashi describes over here is that you're in a boat that is on the Naharot of Eretz Yisrael. You're on rivers in Eretz Yisrael, and you're in a boat in those rivers. What's the status now of the get? As to where the get is written, it's unclear over here, whether the get was written in Chutz Laretz, written in Eretz Yisrael, and seemingly that should make the biggest difference. Not where you're bringing the get when you're on the Sfina, but whether where you bring the get from should make the biggest difference in this situation. You could argue that it was written on the boat itself. Others argue that with regards to this takana, it's not as important where it's written, but rather where it's transported or how it's transported, and that's the makom makes more difference than where it is written, because that was the nature of the takana. So now, Amar Rabbi Yehuda Kasha, that's not a problem. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Rabbonon, it's a machlok Rabbi Yehuda Rabbonon as to the status of a boat on waters that are in Eretz Yisrael. Are you in Eretz Yisrael? Are you not in Eretz Yisrael? And that will be the determining factor over here. That's none. Afar chutz la'aretz habav sfina la'aretz. You have a boat that is packed with dirt that was brought from chutz la'aretz. So the base of the boat, the hull of the boat, is filled with dirt from chutz la'aretz. But you're on a river inside of Eretz Yisrael. So the question, of course, is the dirt that you planted, if you plant in the hull of the boat now where the dirt is, are you planting in chutz la'aretz or are you planting in Eretz Yisrael? So the first says, chayav b'maaser u'b'shvit. You're in Eretz Yisrael, so all the dirt then becomes attached to the ground, in a sense, and since it's attached to the ground, it has a status of Eretz Yisrael. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Eimatai, when is that true? Bizman shvasfina gosheshet. That's only when the boat itself is grounded, meaning that it's in very shallow water, and the hull of the boat, or the base of the boat, is touching the ground. So clearly the machloket here is that Rabbi Yehuda believes that you have to be on the ground of Eretz Yisrael in order to be deemed the land of Eretz Yisrael. So if the boat is touching the ground, then you're on the ground of Eretz Yisrael, and that which is in the boat also then is deemed to be extension of the ground, and you're in Eretz Yisrael. The Chachamim believe that even though you're not touching the ground, the water is seen as an extension of the ground, and therefore you're deemed to be in Eretz Yisrael. So what they're trying to explain here is that's the machloket here in the brayot as to whether when you bring a get, you can say to be bringing a get from Eretz Yisrael or bringing a get from Chutz La'aretz, depends on how you deem it. Now your question is a fair question, which is you're dealing with two different issues. You're dealing with one issue, which is an issue of mitzvot atzvuyot ba'aretz, which is very, very much about the physical ground, versus something else, the get, which is about the borders, and it's not about the ground itself, it's about where you cross over the border between Eretz Yisrael and non-Eretz Yisrael. So how can the Gemara compare them? So Tosafot here, you can look, it's at the bottom, Tosafot makes it clear. He says here, in one direction it's clear, which is that if you deem it to be Eretz Yisrael from Mutzvot HaTuliot Baretz, then you certainly will deem it that way for get. Because if it makes the higher threshold cut to say that it is Mitzvot HaTuliot Baretz, then you certainly will consider it a get. What you can't say is the other way around. Just because you say that it's Chutz La'aretz for Chumot Masrot or Shvi'it, doesn't mean necessarily that it's not Eretz Yisrael for get. So Tosafot says, that's why the Gemara proposes it. In one direction, it's clear. If the Chachamim believe it's good enough for Mitzvot HaTuliot Baretz, they certainly believe it's good enough for get.
So that's the direction they'll make it. Rabbi Yehuda, who says it's not, the Gemara here is assuming that he would also say that by get, but that's not mochrak. That's not where the real connection is. The real connection is when you say it in the positive form.
If the boat is not aground, then patur, you're not patur.
Now here, Tosfot discusses the issue of ematai. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, in other places, mentions that when it comes to Rabbi Yehuda, who's found in a Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda many times is found in the Mishnah, who says, Bamid Dvarim Amurim, or he says, Ematai. Over there, there's a Machloket Amoraim as to when he has that prefix. What is he telling you? Is he arguing or explaining the previous position? Both Amoraim over there say when he says Ematai, he's agreeing with the previous position. This makes that very difficult, because it's clear here the Gemara believes Rabbi Yehuda is arguing on the Chachamim, not agreeing with the Chachamim, or not qualifying the statement of the Chachamim. So Tosfot amends that idea in the Gemara in Sanhedrin and says that is only true when it's used in a Mishnah. But when it's used in a Braita, it does not have that explanation. And therefore, the Mishnah in Chala actually has the same Mishnah, and over there it says Ematai. And so what Tosfot says is, you have a Tosefta here, it's clear a Tosefta because there are lines in here that don't appear in our Mishnah. He says that according to our Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim agree. And the Ematai over there is qualifying the statement of the Chachamim. In the Tosefta that we're quoting over here, it should say Vitani instead of Ditznan. And the Tosefta disagrees and says that Rabbi Yehuda argues on the Chachamim. And that's how Tosefot solves the problem of this Ematai. So now, Abaye Amar, Havah Rabbi Yehuda. Both of these Braitot with regards to the get are authored by Rabbi Yehuda. Within Rabbi Yehuda, you can make the distinction as to whether the boat is touching the floor of the river or whether it's afloat in the river. And that same distinction will be applicable because one case it'll have Kedushat Aretz, one case it will not have Kedushat Aretz. Arev Zera, Atzitz Nakuv, Hamunach Agabi Yetetot. If you have a bucket or a planter that is up on stilts, it's off the ground, then does it have a status of being planted in Eretz Yisrael or status of Kedushat Haaretz? Banu Machloket Rabbi Yehuda Rabbanan. That's a Machloket of Rabbi Yehuda Rabbanan. We just had this. When you have the boat floating in the water, do you have to be touching the ground or not? Amarava Dilmalohi. Maybe that's not the case. Now, what exactly the scenario is over here? Rashi believes over here that the boat was made out of cheres. That the boats here were made out of clay. And on the other hand, the pot that we're talking about here is made out of wood. And because of that, there's going to be a distinction drawn between wood and kli cheres. Tosfot says that Rashi is completely wrong, and he has it backwards. And that the boat was made out of wood, and most boats are made out of wood. How many boats do you know that are made out of clay that are floating around? And the pots were made out of clay, which is the normal thing. He says that stam atzitz in the Mishnah is used many times for a urinal or for other descriptions, and is made out of kli cheres, not made out of wood. Obviously, Rashi has a reason, and Tosfot brings the reason that he thinks Rashi said this. It's based on a Gemara in Menachot that seems to make this connection and say what Rashi is saying. Tosfot nevertheless rejects that explanation because he says it makes more sense, and we'll see why now. Dimalohi, ad kan lo kamer Rabbi Yehuda atam ela bespina asuya livrach. The only reason that he says it over there by a boat, because a boat moves around, meaning that it's bobbing in the water, it's floating and moving in the water. That's why he doesn't deem it as an extension of the land itself, because it's separate from the land. A pot that doesn't move, lo, then that's not the case. Inami, because by the pot, there's airspace between the pot and the ground. On the other hand, when you're in the water is considered to be an extension of the ground. It's as if you were in the ground. Water and the ground are synonymous, even though water is different than dry land, but the water itself sits on the dry land and connects you directly to the dry land. Aval atzitz demafsik avir alone. But on the other hand, a atzitz, where there's airspace in between it, that would not be the case. Now why Tosfot says he thinks he's right is because the Gemara makes a distinction, the Mishnah makes a distinction in other places between an atzitz nakuf and an atzitz she'en nakuf. Whether the pot has a hole in it or whether the pot does not have a hole in it. When a pot has a hole in it, then the Chachamim believe that it is considered to be growing out of the ground because it's nourishing from the airspace and the air of Eretz Yisrael. According to Rabbi Zera, even if it's not sitting on the ground, then it would consider it to be attached to the ground if it has a hole in it. On the other hand, Rova says that you don't have to say that. Only if it's sitting on the ground, maybe the Chachamim agree. But again, it would have to have a hole in it in order for it to be deemed connected to the ground.
On the other hand, if it does not have a hole in it, then it will not be considered to connect to the ground. Whether for Rabbi Zera that means up in this airspace, or according to Rava, even on the ground, if it doesn't have a hole in it. Tosfot says this makes a lot of sense now. Why? Because wood is porous in a sense that if you have wood there, you shouldn't need a hole in order for the item to nourish from the ground or allow the items to seep between them. And a kli cheres is not so porous. So he says it makes sense when you're talking about a natzitz, which is made out of kli cheres, then you're talking about a potter, then you would need a hole in it for it to be able to nourish from the ground. If it doesn't have a hole in it, it's not going to nourish from the ground because it's completely separate. On the hand, wood, which is much more porous and allows for the flow of water or nutrients between them, then even without a hole in it, it's considered connected to the ground. And that's why the boat that is there does not need a hole in it in order to be considered connected to the ground, even according to Rabbi Huda. It just has to be a ground. It doesn't have to be a hole and then allow it to connect to the ground. Therefore, Tosfot favors the interpretation of the Rabbeinu Tam that the kli cheres is the atzitz, because then it makes sense to distinguish between a hole in it and not a hole in it versus the boat, which is eitz. But you see, the Gemara never asks for there to be a hole in the boat, aside from the fact that it won't be a boat anymore if it has a hole in it, but they don't require a hole to connect it to the ground, because it's wood. And wood, by definition, has that porous nature, which allows for it to flow between them. And that's why Tosfot favors his explanation. Relative to kli cheres, to clay or earthenware, wood is much more porous than clay. It doesn't mean that wood allows for the free flow of water, because otherwise, right, boats wouldn't float anymore and you'd have the water fill the hull. Actually, when they put the wood there, they also coated it with pitch in order to make it more waterproof. So it is not completely waterproof. It's somewhat porous, and the pitch helped to make it completely waterproof. So that's why Tosfot favors his interpretation over here. Obviously, this has ramifications today when we talk what's called matzah menutak, which is when you have things that grow off the ground, whether it's in greenhouses or whether it's on raised ground, so it's not on the ground itself, or in a mirpeset, whether they have statuses of being connected to the ground, and then they are subject to mitzvot atuliyot ba'aretz and chayav and trumot masrot and shemitah or not. This sugya is more the pivotal question in that issue as whether deemed to be part of aretz or not part of the aretz. Okay, we'll stop over here on the top of Tafchet, 5 lines down.